Columbus, Indiana native Ryan Nurs is a freelance journalist whose writing has appeared in Esquire magazine, on NPR stations, and on the History Channel. And his ongoing efforts to support what he facetiously calls his bad writing habit have taken him to some unexpected corners of our culture. Nurs spent a year emceeing professional competitive eating contests around the world, then published Eat This Book, a digest, if you will, of his observations and exploits. And in his latest book, Marijuana America, One Man's Quest to Understand America's Dysfunctional Love Affair with Weed, he delves surprisingly deep into a subculture that has consistently informed the ways Americans have thought and behaved since the 1960s. Ryan Nurs joined WFIU's John Bailey to talk about both books, what their topics have to tell us about the American character, and the perils of immersion journalism.
Pot has been a fixture of the American counterculture, at times very, very close to the mainstream, for about five decades. How would you account for its staying power culturally?
I think a big part of its staying power is because of Harry J. Anslinger, the as I call him in the book, the Darth Vader of dope. You know, the man who is sort of almost single-handedly responsible for making marijuana illegal with the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937, and he created such a powerful group of propaganda against pot and sort of villainizing pot, and you know, the most famous being Reefer Madness, the movie. But there were articles, you know, about black men going crazy and raping white women, and it created such an incredible stigma against marijuana, which at that time, in the 20s, 30s, it had been medicine distributed by, you know, Eli Lilly. All the major drug companies had tinctures. There was hemp was very the hemp industry was very important. And then it became this villainized drug that people were legitimately scared about. So then in the 60s, when the real countercultural movement, the sort of anti-Vietnam protests and all that came back, and all these people started trying marijuana, it had this patina of danger that was really unmerited. And when people realized they weren't going crazy, which they almost maybe sort of wanted to, then I think that once that was broken down, it became very sort of accepted quickly into the 70s, where it really spiked. In the early to late 70s was the highest percentage of marijuana use. And then from there, with the drug wars, it's kind of gone up and down. And with the amount that the government vilifies it, sort of maintains this the popularity.
This book is written largely from a first-person perspective, in addition to delving into the history, as you just have a bit. It's a book about a substance that is pervasive in America, but in a lot of the country, it's highly criminalized. Your research took you all around the country to some places that you seem to find particularly uncomfortable. Would you talk about an episode that made you feel acutely nervous during the research?
Sure. Well, as you well know, the beginning of the book starts with me driving quite a bit of marijuana in the trunk of my car across the country in an attempt at sort of Hunter S. Thompson, immersive journalism. With 2020 hindsight, probably not the wisest of decision, but a decent story. And I would say, that sort of first scene of me being tracked by a trooper in Omaha, Nebraska, was definitely the most uncomfortable experience I've ever had with marijuana, where, you know, I had done my research and I knew that I fit the profile exactly, you know, between 20 and 40, male, in a car with a large trunk, coming from California with California license plates, rental car. So that was terrifying. But what's interesting too is that, you know, I'm currently, you know, living in Columbus, Indiana. And, you know, I still smoke marijuana and I don't do it in the house, so I have to go outside. And, there's some policemen in the neighborhood, and there's just people, you know, people with kids. And I know how fearful people can be on, you know, you know, the smallest scale of seeing someone smoking marijuana or smoking from a pipe, you know, not knowing what it is. I I'm familiar with those stigmas, just even from my parents, that that's actually scary on a day-to-day basis. And I think that that's probably the thing that a lot of listeners will relate to, is just the sort of feeling like you're an adult who has to sort of skulk around, as opposed to alcohol, where you can openly embrace drinking and talk about it, even with, you know, coworkers and things like that.
What do you regard as the relative cultural perceptions of weed in a town such as your hometown of Columbus versus a college town like Bloomington or larger cities where you've lived, such as New York?
Good question. There's a massive disparity. I mean, you know, considering that, you know, Columbus and Bloomington are separated by about, you know, 45 minutes to an hour on Highway 46, the difference in perception is massive. I mean, Columbus is a relatively conservative town, very sort of family-oriented, focused on Cummins Engine Company, a lot of professionals. And I think that there is, from my discussions with people there, there's quite a bit of people who do, you know, enjoy marijuana, including professionals who are making plenty of money, totally productive parents who are sort of closet stoners. This is the cannabis closet, as I call it. And there's a lot of those people, but they're not going out with it. They're not talking about it. They'll talk to me a little bit, but they even sort of want to keep that on the down low. Whereas you go just 30 minutes from Columbus to Nashville, it's a very artistic community, very sort of, you know, sort of post-hippie, relaxed. People are very open with it. You know, I talked to a 70-year-old woman the other day who was telling me, you know, said she had gone to some concert in Columbus and was asking kids where she could get weed, you know. And then you come to Bloomington and, you know, I think in general college campuses are sort of the traditional sort of epicenter of marijuana culture from the 60s thereafter. And in Bloomington, you know, the people that I know from Bloomington, pretty much all of them are, if they're not actual smokers, they're absolutely okay with it. You know, they still have to keep it a little bit on the hush, but they do it openly in their own houses. They're not afraid to talk about it. And it's very different. And also, you know, we can sit here and talk about it on air, whereas, you know, the media interest in my book and this topic in Columbus is quite a bit more muted.
You write about a friend of yours from Columbus named Bryce, who was by turns in his teens and 20s a heavy pot smoker and an ardent evangelical churchgoer. Some people at a glance might view this as maybe kind of a struggle within the soul. In what ways do you think use of marijuana reflects or intersects with a search for the spiritual?
That's a great question, because that was in many ways the source of inspiration to write this book and to really persevere with the book proposal. I think that there is, for many people, a very heavy link between the spiritual quest and marijuana usage. You know, if you look at, you know, all Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, and even Marijuana Anonymous, which a lot of people don't know exists, but, you know, the people who become addicted, you know, one of the only ways that they find a way out of those addictions is through the spiritual and, you know, this higher power, you know, as they call it in those. And that's the more extreme version. But the more sort of tangible, practical, everyday version is that I think that in contemporary America, especially, where, you know, so much of our lives are this sort of onslaught of sensory, you know, websites and text messages and Facebook and Twitter and very short, sort of not terribly enriching interactions, very, very quick. I think that there's a inherent spiritual want that people have that is not getting fulfilled. And I think some people use things, alcohol, sometimes prescription drugs like Prozac, Ritalin, things like that, and marijuana. And I think to some extent marijuana is one that is probably works to some extent more effectively than a lot of the other ones, because, you know, alcohol can You know, if you look, ask a lot of people what's caused the most problems in their lives of drugs, and a lot of people will say alcohol is, the, you know, when they've done some of the stupidest things they've done. And, whereas marijuana tends to be less aggressive. It tends to be something where you really get more absorbed in music. You get more absorbed in food and small details of beauty. And, you know, if you think this movie's really amazing, you tend to lean toward the optimistic about your experiences. And you tend to feel that they're more transcendent than they are. These, you know, sort of mundane experiences transcend. So to answer your question briefly, I think that there's – that was one of my main conclusions, is that I really do think that that the use and sometimes even abuse of marijuana it has spiritual roots.
Are you sensing an evolution in the general American mindset regarding marijuana and what it represents?
Absolutely. You know, you look now, we have 18 medical marijuana states in 2013. Two states have legalized recreational marijuana. I mean, that's a pretty staggering development. I guess, was it 1996 where Prop 215 happened in California? So that was the first medical marijuana state. So in a matter of a little over a decade, about 15 years now, it's gone to 18 states, and two states have legalized recreational marijuana. For the first time, some of these polls have shown over 50% of the American public is in favor of legalizing recreational marijuana. So essentially treating marijuana like we treat alcohol and tobacco, taxing, regulating it, having retail stores that sell it. That's pretty staggering. I mean, even to me, I think that, you know, having talked to a lot of people and been surprised by generally conservative people being like, well, yeah, you know, I mean, you're not going to control it. It's a plant. Why don't we just be practical about it? Which is essentially what the Dutch did. People think the Dutch are very liberal. They're actually not that liberal. They're very, very pragmatic. They're like, we know it's going to happen, just like prostitution is going to happen. So we're going to take it and we're going to put it over there, we'll put it in this little place. You can't just walk around Amsterdam smoking a joint. You know, they have a place, they put it there, and they contain it, and they own it and regulate it. And I think America, more out of pragmatism than a real sort of spiritual sort of or intellectual development, is coming to the realization that the war on drugs isn't really working, and this is a potential solution because it's working in the medical marijuana states. And I also think the baby boomers, all those hippies that smoked in the 70s and then went back to get jobs in finance and things like that, they still ultimately have a lenient take on marijuana, and that's becoming the older generation now.
After all you've observed in preparing this book, have mentioned that you still smoke. What, if anything, has made you want to scale back or quit altogether?
Well, you know, as I was writing the book proposal for this, which took a while, I got to a point where, you know, I was having some difficulties. I was a little bit down. I had spent a lot of time in isolation writing my former book, Eat This Book, and I got to that point where I felt like it was becoming negative. It was becoming, I don't know if it was becoming addiction, but it was becoming kind of negative. And, you know, even to the point of, you know, a lot of marijuana smokers sort of think it doesn't really hurt their lungs and things like that, but I was wheezing and, you know, just feeling a little fuzzy a lot, and I just wasn't enjoying it as much. So that was really when I was like, you know, started going to Marijuana Anonymous meetings and just to check it out and see if, you know, maybe there was something there. And more than anything, I think I just wanted some control of it and to be able to get back to that place where it was initially in college where I first discovered it, where it was a source of putting me in that place of sort of a childlike, you know, everything was fresh and new and music sounded amazing and food tasted amazing and sex was amazing. I wanted to get back to that place instead of this place where, you know, you're sort of holed up in a room and it doesn't feel so, you know, it doesn't feel so fun anymore and it doesn't feel so unique. And I think I've gotten back to that place. I've just really dialed back, and I do it when I really feel like I need an attitudinal shift and a fresh new perspective. And I still I still get quite a bit of work done and you know, try to do it responsibly, but I have cut back.
Ryan Nurs, a native of Columbus, is the author of Marijuana America, One Man's Quest to Understand America's Dysfunctional Love Affair with Weed. We'll resume our conversation about his writing, including Eat This Book, A Year of Gorging and Glory on the Competitive Eating Circuit.
I'd like to shift our focus now to another rather peripheral American pastime, and that is competitive eating. You wrote a book a few years back called Eat This Book, A Year of Gorging and Glory on the Competitive Eating Circuit. I think most people are somewhat acquainted with it, at least through the 4th of July Nathan's hot dog eating contest. But I'm wondering if you would just give us a bigger picture of what else happens in the world of competitive eating and who some of the key players have been.
Sure. To me, you know, some of the biggest players around the time when I was really becoming, I was an MC for the International Federation of Competitive Eating, which I call the world governing body of all stomach-centric sport. And, you know, so when I came in, the big player was Kobayashi, Takeru Kobayashi. And everyone knew the little Japanese guy. A lot of times people didn't even know his ethnicity. They're like the little Asian guy, the little Chinese guy who eats all the hot dogs. And he is definitely the star who brought the sport to what it was, the sort of Elvis of competitive eating. He's kind of good, you know, decent looking guy, very quiet, very zen, mysterious. No one knew what his training habits were. He came over out of nowhere. He was this skinny guy. And at the time when he first came in 2001, the record was 25 hot dogs and buns in 12 minutes. And that was by a very large man. And Kobayashi came in and ate 50 hot dogs and buns in 12 minutes and just stunned the world. And more than anything, it was like, how can this small person even fit that in his belly? And then since then, it's really developed quite a bit. Now, there's now Joey Jaws Chestnut from Vallejo, California. He's now the new champion. He's sort of your everyday, sort of normal-looking white guy, a little bit goofy, just happens to have this crazy talent. He actually started his career at the deep fried asparagus eating contest that I announced in Stockton, California at the Stockton Asparagus Festival. He came in and I think came in second. He was just a college kid. No one knew him. And now he's the best competitive eater in the world. I think his record is 69 hot dogs and buns in 10 minutes, which is even shorter. Kobayashi has since been excommunicated from the International Federation of Competitive Eating, also known as Major League Eating. There's guys like Patrick Deep Dish Bertoletti, who has great with hot foods. He's got the jalapeno eating championship. He ate something like 290 jalapenos in 10 minutes. There you've got Sonia Thomas, the Black Widow. Everyone's seen her. She's like under 100 pounds. She's eaten, you know, over 170 chicken wings in 10 minutes. There's a lot of characters. Tim Eater X Janis, who was featured on MTV. He paints his face. He's a very enigmatic sort of character. Crazy Legs Conti, who wears shorts all year round and has dreadlocks. And Eric Badlands Booker, 400-pound guy. Great guy who's also a hip-hop artist. Raps mostly about competitive eating themes. You've got a great cast of characters, and that's really what I tried to focus on in Eat This Book.
You mentioned that you announced one of these contests. You announced several of these contests.
Yes.
You found yourself in the employ of the International Federation of Competitive Eating, a.k.a. Major League Eating. How in the world did that happen?
I have friends in low places, John. really, a good friend of mine named Dave Baer, who shared a sort of similar absurd sense of humor. And he found himself with the Shea Brothers in New York, some guys who did publicity and sort of had also an absurd sense of humor. And they got involved in the Nathan's Famous contest. So Dave Baer started working for the IFOCE. And one day he called me and said, hey, look, I've got this gig in Natchitoches, Louisiana. It's a meat pie eating contest. And he's like, you just got to go down there, wear a suit, wear a straw hat and be a carnival barker and get up there on stage and, you know, dictate the contest. And it became a career, you know, a career move, oddly enough. And I think I ended up overall announcing well over 100 eating contests. I went to 46 states, went to Singapore, did chicken satay in Singapore, mincemeat pies outside of London, did raw onions in Maui. So yeah, it was quite a not so glamorous but interesting career.
This can stay off the record if you'd like, but how did you end up falling out with professional competitive eating?
Yeah, sure. I don't mind. All is on the record for me. It's all I'm willing to expose stuff. Yeah, I mean, I started to feel that there was an element of unhealthfulness to competitive eating. I know that's a shocking revelation, but and you know, I became friends with all these guys. You know, all these guys were my buddies. You know, so I started to know some of their habits of, you know, preparing and winding down, let's say, from these contests. And there were some concerns about it. And also, you know, it was really funny at first. It's very fun and funny, and it really is. But people aren't – eating contests aren't thriving because people are buying tickets. So it's all about sponsorships and you know, food companies like Nathan's Famous and festivals and things like that will sponsor it. So you have to sort of mute any negative messages. And we called whenever someone would vomit, we called that a reversal of fortune. Or so, and we had all kinds of terms like that. You know, Elvis just left the building. You say things like that. And that was an immediate, you know, you immediately disqualified from the contest if that happened during the contest. But, you know, those kinds of things after a while, I just felt, you know, I couldn't really suppress it anymore. And I couldn't as a sort of intelligent adult continue to push it as totally positive and funny and okay.
In the book, you profile a number of professional eaters who represent both sexes, a variety of races and geographical regions, and a range of sizes. What's true of all these competitors? Is there a common thread?
I think the common threads are, A, they do all naturally. They found out sometime in their life that they naturally are fast eaters. Not necessarily that they all had massive capacity. People think that that's what competitive eating is about. But these are all speed contests. Some of them came from big families where eating fast was literally very important. You know, you only had so much food, and if you had a bunch of big brothers, you knew you had to get to it fast. Beyond that, all of them, I think, have a real taste for sort of camaraderie and wanting something outside of their mundane, normal lives. They all have normal jobs, but they want something like to be sort of weekend warriors and have a bunch of buddies, you know. And that's the next thing, is I think is the media part of it. It's part of this reality TV thing where sort of every man can become a celebrity all of a sudden. So a guy who's way overweight and then is a real estate guy in Long Island all of a sudden has a blog, a Twitter feed, a Facebook page with a bunch of likes and people talking about you, and you go on media interviews. So I think a little bit of it is that celebrity culture. And most of them have a pretty good sense of humor. Most of them get it. The Shea brothers at IFOC are very funny. I did my best to make it funny as well. And most of them get that what they're doing is pretty hilarious and a spectacle that people won't forget.
That's journalist Ryan Nurs, author of Eat This Book, A Year of Gorging and Glory on the Competitive Eating Circuit, and his latest foray into gonzo journalism, Marijuana America, One Man's Quest to Understand America's Dysfunctional Love Affair with Weed. He'll be reading from and taking questions about the latter book next Tuesday evening, July 9th at 7 p.m. at Boxcar Books in downtown Bloomington.